Find all sorts of opinions and add your own at the Radio National website.
On RN or online at abc.net.au/RN. Hello, I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for joining me for Big Ideas, our final program for the year. And I'm very happy to report Big Ideas will be back next year on RN in our usual time slot, or as a podcast or download, with four new editions each and every week. This evening, humanities researchers take the challenge to clearly and succinctly explain what exactly it is that they do, why it is interesting, why it's important. The catch is that they have only 3 minutes to tell their stories. That's coming up later in the program. But first, we hear about social impact investing. It's a new and experimental way to fund and to deliver social services. But can it be applied to the arts and cultural sector? Professor Peter Shergold thinks the idea has merit and outlines his enthusiasm for social benefit bonds at a recent Currency House breakfast event at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Sydney. Professor Shergold is Chancellor of the University of Western Sydney, and among his many roles and career highlights, he was the founding director of the Centre for Social Impact and Secretary of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet during the Howard government. To explain what social benefit bonds are and how they might supplement traditional forms of arts funding, here now is Professor Peter Shergold. His topic, impact investment in culture.
The world of mission is changing. It's changing profoundly. It's changing in ways that significantly challenge institutions. The institutions that seek to fund the achievement of mission. And that's true whether mission is defined by faith or secular ethos, whether mission is articulated socially, assisting the disadvantaged, supporting the needy, speaking out for the oppressed, or articulated environmentally, preserving biodiversity, promoting renewable resources, or articulated culturally, presenting the arts, maintaining cultural heritage, creating social identity. Whether the organisations envisage themselves as charitable ventures or as non-profit institutions or as advocacy organisations, and very often it's a mix of those, the world in which they operate is undergoing extraordinary transformation that is as unarguable as it is largely unheralded. And of course, not-for-profits are themselves active players in changing the paradigm that creates beneficial public impact. Australia's loose network of 600,000 not-for-profits, 60,000 registered with the Australian Charities and Not-for-Profit Commissions, is, to the casual listener, a sort of raucous cacophony of disparate voices. Some of them organisations competing, some collaborating, often I've discovered studiously ignoring what each other are doing, even though they share similar goals and similar ambitions. Some of these organisations are international, think Oxfam or Red Cross. Many are large national bodies, think Mission Australia or the Smith family. Although, as most of you in this room know, many of those large national bodies are actually, just beneath the surface, a rather uncomfortable mix of state institutions. Most of these not-for-profits, the great majority, are small, they're local, they're community-based organisations. What they share is a mission. They're defined by purpose, not by profit. They're defined and work in a world of stakeholders, not shareholders, in which philanthropic gifts of funding and bequests and donations, and philanthropic gifts of time, think over 6 million volunteers, are crucial. But increasingly, those not-for-profit organisations, and they include many new startups, not just the well-established organisations, those not-for-profits increasingly, not exclusively, see themselves as social enterprises. They recognise not only that they need to manage the delivery of their social or environmental or cultural mission efficiently and effectively, realise that they need to focus on resource allocation and pricing and risk management, strong governance, effective public accountability. But more importantly, that the delivery of mission depends on financial sustainability. They need to get started, to survive, to scale up, to innovate. They increasingly regard their organisations as social ventures, themselves as social entrepreneurs. That's the first big change that is well underway. Metaphorically, that, if you will, is the first of my wins. And the second win shift is occurring in governance. Because if you take nothing else with you, take this one key statistical fact, that for not-for-profit organisations like many represented in this room, for every dollar of donation you receive, $5 comes from government. Within a year, about $5.1 billion is donated to the not-for-profit sector. $25.5 billion comes in government funding. The state, in other words, is important. The state, of course, traditionally delivered public purpose in two ways. It delivered infrastructure and services directly through public servants. And it supported organisations seen to be benefiting the public good by providing them with subsidies in the form of grants. Now, in the last generation, the last 25 years, that's changed, in part through public-private partnerships of varying sorts to build ports and roads and airports and railways, but particularly in the service sector, in which most social enterprises operate, it's changed because governments now contract not-for-profit organisations to deliver government programmes, human services, overseas aid, environmental programmes, and, I'd have to say, far less often, cultural events. In other words, grants of subsidy, the traditional means of supporting community engagement, is year by year giving way instead to payments by government for delivering government services. And accompanying this impulse to outsource, although accompanying it, I think, far too slowly, comes an increasing drive to performance-based outcomes, to pay for results, not for process. The third change that is taking place is, of course, in the private sector, with increasing recognition over the last generation that businesses, with their inevitable externalities, need an implied license to operate in society, to exhibit themselves as good corporate citizens, behaving not just within the law, but ethically. So you will all know that emerging in the 1990s as triple bottom line reporting, the corporate citizenship movement took shape early this century with CSR, corporate social responsibility. But the GFC nearly killed CSR. The GFC was as much a shock to social responsibility as it was to prudential regulation of financial behaviour. Many companies extolled for the role that they had played in leading CSR in reducing their carbon footprint, in employing minorities, in feeding the homeless, and yes, yes, in supporting the arts. Many of those corporately, socially responsible companies, it turns out, did not carry that CSR into the heart of their business. Think Lehman Brothers in the US, think Northern Rock in the UK. The sad truth has led to a fundamental rethink of CSR. Because if it's just seen as an addition to corporate endeavour, if it's just a way of gilding brand image, it may in fact be of limited value, creating marginal social impact. So increasingly, the companies that I see at the forefront are now moving instead to articulate what they do as shared value. As shared value. A recognition that doing good shouldn't be seen as some addition to the business or as an offset to the business. It should be the way of doing the business. There's a recognition that businesses themselves create not just financial value, but social value. And that social value can be enhanced, and importantly, financial value with it, by focusing on corporate investment in business-related activities. So, for example, banks may increasingly devote their foundations and their community support to addressing issues of financial exclusion. Cocoa producers, well, think NAB, think Westpac, both doing that now. Cocoa producers may direct their energies to ensuring that poor families are helped to farm and market their crops more effectively. Think Nestle. That sports good manufacturers may focus their efforts on excluding and combating the use of child labour in their production. Think Nike. This focus on shared value, on corporate investment, is changing the way we regard social impact in positive ways. But, this may be profoundly challenging in the years ahead for those social enterprises in the cultural arena. It may mean that companies may direct their efforts more exclusively, more directly, to shared value initiatives, in which arts activities might be seen as more peripheral. And more challenging still, it may mean that where businesses or government bodies do continue to invest in the arts, that it will be with strings attached. That strings either in the form of explicit conditions or implicit expectations. Think, for example, the Western Australian Opera. The creation by business of shared financial and social value may mean that corporate providers expect their social investment to share or reflect their values, not just to add to their brand image by supporting sporting or cultural events. And even where that's not the case, social media, we now know, is giving voice to those who want to prevent arts organisations taking money from companies or from individuals who they believe are inappropriate because of the corporate activities that give rise to the funding that is being proffered. At the same time, the divestment movement is gathering pace. The willingness of universities and church organisations in particular to divest investment holdings is likely to extend. And this, in my view, is very dangerous ground indeed. This, if you want, is the dark cloud that I see. Organisations like Santos may be dumped in opposition to their coal seam gas development or their coal production, even when they have taken the lead in Indigenous employment and economic development, or indeed in sponsoring the arts. If the Sydney Biennale can be persuaded not to take money on a really dubious connection between an individual and a company operating an offshore detention centre, the next target will be to persuade arts organisations not to take money from the government which policy established the centre. But the good news is that this dark cloud does have a silver lining, and that's the fourth change underway, the rise of the ethical or socially responsible investor, because increasingly individual investors also want to balance their financial returns with social expectations. If you like, think of this as a different perspective on shared value. Individuals don't just want to see investment companies carefully weight the environmental, social, and governance arrangements in the businesses chosen for investors. They also increasingly want to put their money into vehicles that allow them to avoid investments in products that they do not wish to support, such as tobacco, or gambling, or munitions, or, yes, coal. Until now, those investors, increasingly influential, have only been able to negatively screen their investments. Now, and this is where it gets exciting, new opportunities are emerging where they can positively screen their investments, where the individual investors can say, yes, I want to invest in this product or activity which creates social value, and by that action also to receive a financial return. And in a world of private ancillary funds and workplace giving, this becomes increasingly significant. And all these four wind shifts, the emergence of social enterprises, the government contracting on the basis of outcomes, the recognition of shared value businesses, and the growth of socially responsible investors come together at an exciting new axis. It's impact investing. What's emerging, the silver lining, are new financial vehicles that allow the overlapping needs of not-for-profits and governments and private investors, companies, individuals, to come together for social purpose. It's often associated with the development of social impact bonds in the UK or US, or social benefit bonds here in New South Wales. But bonds, as Rosemary knows well, are only one means by which to give expression to impact investing. But let's take bonds as a means of making my discussion concrete now and opening up discussion on the relevance to the arts. Bonds are a means by which a government can offer a performance-based contract to an organisation to deliver a public purpose. In New South Wales, it's to reduce the extent of out-of-home care for children having to be removed from their families. You could apply it, it is being applied elsewhere, to prisoner recidivism or to increase social housing and so on. The social enterprises in New South Wales, it's Uniting Care and the Benevolent Society, agree to enter into a contract. They shoulder the risk, but they're given the freedom to innovate in the way that they want to. And if their results are successful, they are paid for those results. Individual investors at this stage in the wholesale market, with the support of financial intermediaries, are then given the opportunity to contribute those funds in a market. In New South Wales, it was $8 million and $10 million respectively. And then those organisations are able to repay the bond holders, in effect quasi-equity holders, if the government pays. The greater the success, the more the success fees to the social enterprises, and the more generous the rate of return for the investment. Now, I think that this approach can be extended to a much wider range of social missions. Week before last, I was talking to the Joint Parliamentary Committee on Foreign Affairs, saying this is absolutely suited not to all, but to much of overseas aid. We can develop development impact bonds. For example, if you want to help organisations increase the number of girls going to school in developing countries. But I know what you're thinking, I think. Stopping prisoners reoffend, or lowering the incidence of children having to be placed in care, or reducing homelessness, or increasing the number of girls at school are all much easier to measure than the outcomes of a cultural initiative. But I have to tell you, in this room, even in the areas I've spoken about, they are remarkably hard to measure. Perhaps you'll all go on to your rest of your day thinking, well, that was vaguely interesting, but not much relevant to me. Well, I hope not, for although this is not my area of expertise, I am persuaded that impact investment can be applied to the creative arts. True, in the social and government arena, the mechanism is often to turn a stream of cost savings via performance-based contract into a flow of income for investors who, through a social enterprise, have achieved the result. Its virtue, if you think about it, is above all, is its funding investment in prevention, which government does far, far too rarely, rather than just endlessly expending on crisis management. That's its key attraction. In the arts arena, it seems to me that that fundamental equation is somewhat different. It's more, I think, like the model epitomised by the investment in Good Start in early childcare. In other words, this is how it would work. It's how to fund an upfront investment in a high-risk venture. Most arts are high-risk ventures that may attract future income through sales or commissions or paying audiences. Albeit, most of us would accept that it's generally unlikely that the revenue will fully offset production costs. There's also a variation: how to fund a reduction in the ongoing costs of artistic production, through allowing perhaps arts organisations or artists' co-ops or even individuals to own rather than rent or lease their own studios or their own housing. Now, does this sound familiar? I reckon it should do. Think the funding of university students. In a sense, what I'm talking about here is income investment almost as a form of income contingent loan, to be repaid at least partially through flows of income over time as they eventuate. Now, don't please misinterpret my undoubted enthusiasm. I don't see impact investment replacing government grants and philanthropic donations and corporate sponsorships as the source of arts funding, nor should it. The new investment vehicle that I'm talking about should be seen to supplement and complement other funding sources. And can it happen? Well, yes, it can, and not just overseas. I just choose four Australian examples to finish off that can show how impact investment can help to sustain artistic creativity. The first is the work of Forrester's Community Finance, which, amongst their social enterprise clients, have a number of arts organisations. They provide competitive loans, low cost, low doc, high risk, where banks have traditionally feared to tread. They comprehend, Foresters, the value of microfinance to buy accommodation, to purchase equipment, to develop ideas. In effect, persuading arts organisations that they can organise themselves to repay loans which over time significantly reduce their operating expenses and maximise the value of the funding they receive from other sources. So Forrester's Community Finance, for example, have funded the artery cooperative, allowing the purchase of a warehouse to create subsidised studios for professional artists. Second example is the work of QUT Creative Enterprise Australian up in Brisbane. And that has taken the well-established mechanism of small business incubators and then applied it and given it an artistic twist. So they offer business mentoring support and early stage investment to creative industries, such as fashion and design and film and TV and interactive media. The third example, Rosemary touched on in passing, the establishment of a managed investment fund for the Australian Chamber Orchestra, which allows individuals to invest in fine instruments, the value of which is likely to rise over time, and then lending those instruments to performers. So as the Stradivarius is played to perfection, so its worth as a capital investment increases. And fourth, I think most interesting and an absolute tribute to Cathy Hunt, the recent establishment of the Arts Business Innovation Fund in Queensland, $1 million fund, half of it state money, half of it from the Tim Fairfax Family Foundation, awarded not, as you might expect, as a grant and not as a philanthropic gift, but as a source of investment, a sum of money of which some significant part must be taken as a non-interest loan to be repaid and then reinvested in future arts activities. Perhaps organisations will choose to dig into their existing resources to repay. Far better, I think, they may plan to achieve a stream of income that can help to subsidise their long-time artistic ambitions and repay the funding on that basis. These are all small, but fascinating beginnings, I think. They suggest just a few ways in which traditional funding can be enhanced by impact investing, in a way, ironically, which may end up giving greater creative freedom than grants or gifts or corporate sponsorship, and in which creativity can take the form of entrepreneurship to build sustainable arts, to fund cultural mission into the future. In this new world, it may turn out that a financial instrument, debt perhaps, or equity perhaps, may turn out to have less strings attached than a government grant, or a company sponsorship, or even a philanthropic donation. The world of business may paradoxically offer more artistic autonomy. It is at least worth considering. Thank you.
Professor Peter Shergold, Chancellor of the University of Western Sydney and Founding Director of the Centre for Social Impact. His talk on impact investment in culture was presented at a recent Currency House Business and Creativity Breakfast at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Sydney. On RN or online at abc.net.au, you're with Big Ideas. I'm Paul Barclay. Let's hear now from seven researchers who are about to share with us clearly and succinctly just what it is that they do. They've each got 3 minutes to explain to a panel of judges what their research is all about and why it's interesting and important. To introduce each speaker and their topic, I'll hand you over to Professor Stephen Swartz, CEO of CHASS, the Council for Humanities, Arts and Social Sciences.
So it's now time for me to introduce the first speaker, and that's Tom Clark. Tom's the Discipline Group Leader for Writing, Communication and Culture at Victoria University here in Melbourne. So welcome, Tom.
In 2008, Australia's Prime Minister said sorry to the stolen generations. Who's sorry? For what exactly? We're expecting a referendum on recognising Australia's original inhabitants in the Constitution soon. What will that mean? These are core issues for Aboriginal reconciliation, But I think we need to get a clear handle on why non-Indigenous Australians would care about them, because that's 97% of the resident population. Do any ordinary people actually regard themselves as non-Indigenous, let alone ordinary? The only satisfactory reply to such questions is to ask. And so, with Australian Research Council support, we've commissioned 8 focus groups of non-Indigenous Australians around Australia at 4 sites, Sydney, Bega, Perth and Gladstone. At each site, there's been a group born in Australia and a group born overseas. And these groups have been discussing their sense of non-Indigenous responsibility for the current and historical situation of Australia's Aboriginal peoples. Unsurprisingly, we found strong ideological disagreements between participants, as well as some significant differences across the groups. But we've been very struck by some important similarities too, and as a poetics researcher collaborating with political scientists, I've been particularly interested in the stuff around language style. We've seen an uncontested sense, an unstated consensus across our participants that the relationship between Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples does merit further work, and that reconciliation is an adequate label for that work, and this is quite contrary to some expert opinion. These non-Indigenous participants all speak in the terms of a core paradigm of pronouns, an us and them, where we means all non-Indigenous Australians, however recently arrived. Yeah? In other words, we is a distinct bargaining unit in this scene. This we understands reconciliation as something to negotiate with them, which refers to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. So, what does the we want to negotiate with the them? Australia must enable a sense its non-Indigenous we has figured out our negotiating position. Because only then can negotiation start from points of consensus about what needs reconciling. This is deliberative democracy at work, a phrase you may be familiar with. The idea is any democracy needs conceptual anchors to help it address such complex questions about itself. That is of the nature of democracy. And so the next stages of our research will drill down with one-to-one interviews, exploring how a country like Australia might enable just such a deliberation. How can the we get genuinely ready to negotiate with the them in this scene?
Thanks very much, Tom. That was Tom Clark from Victoria University. The next speaker is Karen Farquharson. She's Associate Dean for Research and Engagement in the Department of Education and Social Sciences at Swinburne University. Welcome, Karen.
In 2007, a young Sudanese-Australian man named Leib Goni was murdered at Noble Park train station in Melbourne. Media reports of Goni's murder focused on the fact that he had been murdered by a gang of Sudanese thugs, and the reports raised questions about the ability of Sudanese peoples to integrate into Australian society. These concerns were echoed by the then Minister for Immigration, Kevin Andrews, who was concerned about the ability of Sudanese migrants to fit into Australian society. Turns out that Goni was actually murdered by 2 young white Australian men who had been going out with the intention to do a racist bashing. He wasn't murdered by a gang of Sudanese. Nevertheless, the negative media representations have had ongoing impacts, according to our Sudanese participants in our study, on their lives. So, what do you do if you are a minority community, such as the Sudanese and South Sudanese, about having a media voice? One of the most striking things about the media coverage of the Goni case was the absolute lack of Sudanese or South Sudanese voices. No one was interviewed. Police, government officials, non-government organizations spoke on behalf of the Sudanese. The Sudanese were not asked to speak on behalf of themselves. In 2010, we put together the AusSud Media Project. The AusSud Media Project was a journalism training program and a media intervention. The media intervention had 3 parts. The first part was to train interested Sudanese and South Sudanese Australians to write their own and report their own stories for the media. The second part was to help them to engage with the mainstream media, both by working with journalists as sources for journalist stories, but also enabling them to talk back when the media didn't represent their group accurately. The third part was an intervention with the journalists themselves. So we wanted to link working journalists with members of the Sudanese community so that they could improve their reporting. All participants in the training program, about 35 of them, were paired with working journalists across all forms of media. All the training was provided by working journalists, some of them quite senior. So all the journalists who participated in the program, therefore, had links with the Sudanese community. The outcomes of the project were that the people who participated in the project did feel they had a better engagement with the media and did feel heard. They wrote some stories in mainstream media, some stories on their own blog, and many of them have been quoted in the mainstream media. As I said, all the journalists who were involved in the project now have links for the Sudanese community. The project also raises some challenges for us, and one of those challenges is clearly it works. It's a good way of helping minority communities to have a media voice. But it's expensive. And one of the challenges, ongoing challenges, is training up new people who might be interested, and sustainability. And so that's where I'll leave you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Karen. That's Karen Farquharson from Swinburne University. Next up is Joe Lindsay, who's the convener of sociology and gender studies in the School of Social Science at Monash University. Joe's also the president of the Australian Sociological Association. Welcome, Joe.
I'm going to talk about overconsumption, and I'm going to talk about starting in your backyard. So the problem that we have is that we are consuming too much stuff. This is leading to environmental destruction and global warming, as you can see. And I want to talk about the Australian backyard as an example of this. The Australian backyard is shrinking and it's heating up. We have larger houses on smaller lots with very few trees and little green space. And this really started taking off in the 1990s. Now, it's a problem for the environment because there's limited biodiversity in suburbs, there's poor microclimate in terms of loss of shade, there's poor stormwater management if we've got no green space around our houses. There's reduced opportunities for carbon capture and pollution removal if we don't have trees and grass. There's increased electricity consumption for cooling and lighting in our houses. And obviously, this makes for problems for people too. So we have uncomfortable houses and yards. It's difficult for us to interact with the public realm, particularly when you've got your garage out the front and you just drive into that and don't see your neighbours. There's little space for sitting out, for children to play outside, for drying laundry, for growing food. You have dark interiors with little natural ventilation and no outlook. So what can we do to solve this? It's not an easy thing. It's a wicked problem. As I said, overconsumption is a wicked problem. It's a difficult thing to solve. But my main contribution to the debate and the focus of research that I am working on now and would like to develop is that we need to recognise that most of our consumption is social. People buy things and use things because they're wanting to enact their relationships and belonging. So, of course, systematic problems need to be solved to solve the problem of our backyard. We need to think about the economy, about planning, and about public awareness and debate around green backyards. We also need to manage social change better. As parents work longer hours and commuting times stretch out and our suburbs become denser. But the three photos I've put up here are really to get you to think about the houses in those outer suburbs. And there are people there who are living their social lives and their family lives. That's why they're out there. So on the left, those kids could do with some shade. The ones in the middle, they could do with some green space. And the family on the right could do with some back space in their yard as well as some front space. So, what we need to do, I want to put to you that we need to take our social relationships into account and make sure that these are central in the way that we go about solving the problem of the shrinking backyard. Backyards provide important social services, our relationships and our interaction with nature, as well as ecosystem services. Cooling, stormwater management, etc. We need to grow our community connection to local environments and to green backyards. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. That was Joe Lindsay from Monash. The next speaker is Graham Oppy. Graham Oppy is the head of the School of Philosophical, Historical and International Studies at Monash University. He's also chair of the Council of the Australasian Association of Philosophy. Please welcome Graham.
The guiding question for my research is, does God exist? On its own, this question is intractable. As with other philosophical questions, there's no method to follow in seeking to answer it. Moreover, there's no serious prospect of reaching an agreed answer. There are, however, related questions that are more tractable. There are questions about arguments. Are there persuasive arguments that God exists, that God doesn't exist, that we should suspend judgment on the question whether God exists? There are also questions about reason and rationality. Can you reasonably believe that God exists, that God doesn't exist, that we may or maybe that we should suspend judgment on the question? And there are questions about divine attributes. What properties would God have if God existed? What would God be like if there were a God? The most tractable questions concern the arguments about the existence of God. While we can't assess arguments that haven't yet been developed, we can certainly assess all of the arguments developed so far. I've spent a great deal of my career doing this. So far, I've found that we don't have any arguments on any side that ought to persuade. I say this result's unsurprising. If we did have arguments that ought to persuade, we'd all agree on the answer to my central question. The questions about reason and rationality are also moderately tractable. Difficulties arise because there are many different things that you might mean by reason and rationality. However, we can certainly identify different meanings for these terms and try to answer our questions under those different meanings. So far, I've found that if our interpretation sets low standards for reasonableness, any of theism, atheism, or agnosticism can be reasonably adopted. If our interpretation sets high standards for reasonableness, we're unable to determine whether any of these positions can be reasonably adopted. The questions about divine attributes are not much more tractable than the central question about existence. There are many different conceptions of God and no clear methods to pursue in trying to determine which of those conceptions would be realised if there were a God. Certainly, we can show that some conceptions of God are inconsistent, but there are many conceptions of God that have not yet been shown to be inconsistent. In short, I haven't found persuasive arguments on any side. I haven't found any standards for reasonableness or rationality under which one side is favoured by others. Should I be disappointed with these outcomes? I don't think so. Public and academic discussions of these questions typically generate no light and vast quantities of heat. Those discussions would be much improved if everyone took to heart the lessons that I've learnt from my research.
The next speaker is Robert Finnian, who's Deputy Dean of the School of Humanities and Creative Arts at Flinders University. He's also the Director of the Australasian Consortium of Humanities Research Centres. Yep. Robert, it's your turn.
Look at these guys. Old white guys in wigs, as my daughter likes to point out. What could possibly be the point of researching them these days? My answer is because what they did was crucial in the development of that complex beast, a free press. How they did it has urgent lessons about how that freedom can be maintained in countries like Australia, how developed elsewhere. So who are they? They're three friends from early 18th century Britain, some of the greatest satirists in the language. On the top is Jonathan Swift, because that's where I think he belongs, author of Gulliver's Travels. In the middle, Alexander Pope, the master of the heroic couplet, author of the Dunciad. And on the bottom, John Gay, the author of the great comic opera, The Beggar's Opera. They were the first satirists to write flagrantly and openly against the government of their day, that government of Sir Robert Walpole. Before them, political satire was prosecuted as sedition. After them, it was grudgingly tolerated. They found one of the essential, if not sufficient, conditions of a modern free press, in large part because Walpole chose not to take them on with oppressive force. They survived. He chose instead to take them on with that spin and shamelessness which we've all come to know and love amongst politicians in relatively democratic countries. So it worked for him. Walpole was the first and longest-serving Prime Minister. My point is that a free press is not only the freedom to discuss public issues in a measured and sensible manner, it must be a theatre for the public emotions. Among these, the emotions of anger, disgust and contempt that characterise satire, emotions that we now know an awful lot more about because of recent cognitive scientific research. Civil society needs space for spectacular incivility. So the fact that my dead white guys got away with it is integral to the freedom that gives us this, which is a cartoon from the last days of the 2013 election campaign. Perhaps you argue this development of satire is not is now just history, something we can take for granted so we can focus our research dollars on innovation rather than conservation. I don't think so for two reasons. Firstly, my guys lived in the first great age of print. We live in the first great age of digital media. That is changing the rules, and knowing what the fundamentals are is a crucial anchor for understanding how those rules can and should change. And secondly, these young women, Pussy Riot, live in a country where satire is suppressed. Billions live in similar conditions. How to bring those passions out into the open in Russia, China, even Singapore, depends on knowing what works and why. Of course, things pan out differently in different times and places, but there's a line between my dead white guys and the living rebels who are Pussy Riot. The work that helps us draw that line can make us a more open and tolerant world. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robert. Our next person to speak is Deb Verhoeven, who's the chair of the Department of Media and Communication at Deakin University. Welcome, Deb.
For the past 3 years, I've been working on ways to help people navigate a path through the expanding world of online information. Computers have conclusively changed the way we undertake our research. Digitisation now means that a trip to the library is only a few keystrokes away. As academics in an age of information abundance, we need to learn new ways to discover things and to make sure we are discoverable. And we need to do this in ways that are aligned with our disciplinary outlooks. In the humanities and creative arts, for example, research is often conceived as an exciting journey to an uncertain location rather than the instrumental solving of problems. In recent years, librarians and computer scientists have applied themselves to the challenge of digital information retrieval. Many of their strategies are designed to produce more efficiency in information seeking, to seek the shortest path. But this is to misjudge the value of information meandering for many humanities researchers. What we really want is the online equivalent of wandering into the library to find a particular book and unexpectedly spying another equally useful book out of the corner of our eye. The goal, in effect, is to increase the opportunities for serendipitous discovery in online research. Serendipity can be defined as those happy accidents where a researcher discovers through a combination of luck and acumen something of value they didn't even know they wanted. It's based on a type of non-prescriptive and inclusive thinking in which non-logical connections are just as important as logical ones. To put it simply, serendipity is the X factor of humanities research. The trouble is most online resources are not well suited to serendipitous discovery. Google, for example, is great at telling you what you already know based on where you've already been. The result is that a great deal of online research is stuck in a self-contained bubble. Finding an escape route that leads to fresh approaches and new discoveries seems impossible. The semantic web might offer one avenue by delivering meaning and structure to information, but the technologies to support it are still developing. These are the sorts of challenges we faced when we created the Humanities Networked Infrastructure, or HUNI. HUNI is a new digital platform for anyone seeking to understand more about Australia's diverse and abundant cultural heritage. We wanted HUNI to help people navigate humanities and creative arts information in ways that would produce the most inspiring outcomes. Rather than standardising contributing datasets to produce uniform search results, HUNI harnesses the insights of the crowd to create a sense of surprise. HUNI is explicitly designed to help you discover what you don't already know. How? By allowing researchers to build their own network of pathways between information resources and then linking these to the avenues built by other researchers, HUNI crowdsources for serendipity. The success of HUNI then is dependent on the collaboration of its participants, their generosity, and their commitment to open sharing. In this way, HUNI helps us to reimagine both our relationships to information and to each other. By becoming part of the HUNI research community, you too might just get lucky.
Thank you, Deb. This is kind of an X factor for house researchers, isn't it? The last speaker today, because her name comes at the back of the alphabet, is Andrea Whitcomb, who's director of the Cultural Heritage Centre for Asia and deputy director of the Alfred Deakin Research Institute at Deakin University. Welcome, Andrea.
We all recognise how heritage is used to establish forms of collective identity. It seems innocuous enough and indeed expected. What we don't so often think about are the downsides of this use of heritage. As major conflicts indicate, heritage sites are one of the first things that get destroyed when people go to war with one another. However, there are plenty of everyday contexts in which we need to think about as well. This is particularly so in contexts where there are culturally diverse societies, indigenous populations, and difficult histories that need acknowledgements. Now, the first response to this problem has been incorporating forgotten voices with the aim of promoting tolerance. However, this largely fails because it is built on a declamatory pedagogy, which privileges the giving of voice rather than establishing conversations across differences. It also fails because tolerance involves unequal power relations. So what we need, then, are exhibition strategies that encourage people to recognise how they are entangled with each other, what I call a pedagogy of feeling. Why? Because difficult histories in societies that aim to build social cohesion based on principles of valuing cultural diversity imply a need to overcome distance between self and other, a need to address multiple audiences in ways that foster dialogue between them, and a perspective that does not separate the past from the present and the future. So my work, then, seeks to identify exhibitions and heritage sites that aim to do these things and analyses the way in which they do this. I do so by analysing how these exhibitions challenge collective narratives that erase difficult histories, by demonstrating the ways in which our historical experiences are mutually constituted rather than separate parallel stories. And I look at the ways in which these exhibitions provide a space in which to realise that the past is an unfinished business. I have found that these exhibitions will stage encounters that work through the senses in ways that promote a deep emotional as well as thoughtful engagement, that they will be doing different things for different audiences, such as providing affirmation to those who were dispossessed, while simultaneously challenging the collective memory of those engaged in the dispossessing. And that there will be a strong sense of first-person narrative voice rather than impersonal third-person voice of the institution, giving a sense that a testimony is being given and that you are invited to be the witness. So the result is knowing how to produce representations of heritage that recognise that our futures are tied to how we think of each other. As Gungahlu elder Lilla Watson put it at the Immigration Museum here in Melbourne, if you have come here to help me, you are wasting your time. But if you have come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together. Thank you.
Andrea Whitcomb, Director, Cultural Heritage, Centre for Asia and the Pacific at Deakin University. You've been listening to highlights of Speed Dating for CHASS Researchers, presented at this year's Council for the Humanities, Arts and Social Sciences Annual Forum in Melbourne. So who grabbed the judge's attention? Well, the winner was the first speaker, Tom Clark from Victoria University, and his three-minute talk on reconciliation. And who did the audience like? Well, they voted for Deb Hoven from Deakin, who told us about serendipity and online research, and Robert Fadian from Flinders, who spoke about freedom of the press. That's it for Big Ideas for tonight and indeed for the year. So on behalf of everyone who's worked on the show in 2014, our sound engineers, David LeMay, Peter McMurray, Costa Zorlio, Steve Fieldhouse, Jim Usher, and producers Karen Zvanovitz, Lindy Rain, and Ian Coombe, I'm Paul Barclay. Hope you have a wonderful Christmas break, and I hope you can enjoy our summer season as well. We look forward to bringing you more Big Ideas once again in 2015. Until next year, bye for now.
They're the millennials, and they might as well have targets painted on their chests.
In the U.S., they account for over 21% of consumer discretionary purchases, which is more than $1 trillion U.S.
But they're not all dumb as digital donuts.
I think this is the most sophisticated generation we've ever seen in understanding media.
Chasing the Millennials, part two of our look at the changing nature of advertising. That's Future Tense, and you can download the program from the RN website or look for us on iTunes.